Hi, I'm Dr. Mark Gold, and I'm here today with Dr. Steven Stanos, and he's the director of pain services at the Swedish Hospital in Washington State. But better than that, he's a national expert on pain assessment and pain management in general. You know, when I've taught neuroanatomy for over 40 years, and when it came to the pain sections, I didn't feel like we knew as much as we should about pain neuroanatomy and pathophysiology of pain. Could you like update me since I've been retired?
I know, no problem with being retired. So, you know, our understanding of pain pathophysiology is still evolving. I think what's been interesting now, the old understanding was we thought of nociceptive, neuropathic, and then some for a little bit of time talking about mixed pain conditions. The new understanding is that there's nociceptive pain, there's neuropathic pain, and there's, in the middle of that, what's called central sensitization, where there's, the term's actually been updated by an ICD-11 in the International Association for the Study of Pain to be called nociplastic pain.
Nociplastic.
So the idea is with nociplastic pain is it's central sensitization, conditions like fibromyalgia, or other conditions where there's no longer direct injury to the nociceptors, but there's a change in the somatosensory system. And so irritable bowel conditions, other central pain conditions fit under this nociplastic window. And what's interesting about it is that the taxonomy understands that you can have neuropathic pain, say from postherpetic neuralgia, but that can also cause sensitization. So you could have neuropathic pain with nociplastic pain. And the same with nociceptive pain. Nociceptive pain in the past we thought of conditions like osteoarthritis. Well, osteoarthritis, even though it's an example of elbow pain, you have elbow trauma or you have arthritis in that inflammatory response. There's also changes in your central nervous system because of that chronic input. So the good thing is we have kind of this, we've broken it down in three areas, neuropathic, nociceptive, and then nociplastic in the middle.
And does sensitization apply to all of them?
I think to a degree. Nociplastic pain is probably where there's a predominance of sensitization. And again, whether we really can identify injury or there's been recovery to the nervous system. In many of these chronic pain conditions, the nervous system recovers, but it recovers in an abnormally elevated state, and hence this new terminology around nociplastic pain.
Is there a way to diagnose sensitization?
No, there isn't. You know, there's animal models and some human models look at different ways to test pain response. But those in themselves, you can't really have a clinical test in the exam room. We do think some patients with sensitization may have lowered thresholds. And then again, that's the underlying mechanism maybe for fibromyalgia and those types of conditions where you palpate different areas of the body and now their touch and pain perception is those thresholds for firing are lowered. But there's not really a clinical test to test for sensitization.
I mean, I'm also interested in the area of eating. And is it true that if you're starving, you have less pain sensitization or less pain? Or is that just an old wives' tale?
I'm not sure about the effect on starvation in those different neural pathways. And there's also issues around distraction in memory.
So it would be tough.
There's so many different, I think you're touching upon, I think, in a really important area, just our understanding of the brain function. How does the brain feel our body, respond to pain? How does the brain modulate addiction, reward? All of those things overlap, and even though we've learned a lot more about the neural systems and how they fire with regards to the brain, those systems are still so complex. But it's a lot better than it was 5 and 10 years ago, and hopefully as we start to identify those better, we can see changes. A lot of work's been done in fibromyalgia, a lot of chronic pain conditions where we can actually see those changes in the brain, and related to that, also with addiction, and what's that close overlap between addiction, pain, reward mechanisms.
When you look at pathophysiology, there's a lot more in the way of receptor systems and brain systems involved than just endorphin kind of pathways.
Right.
There's a big list that you had.
Right.
Probably, which are all targets for new pharmaceuticals.
Correct.
But what could you do to make that easy for us to understand?
Well, I think it's, you mentioned something very important. We use a lot of medicines in medicine to treat pain in different conditions, but what's the real mechanism of that medicine? So if we think of pain in the periphery, we have peripheral sensitization. Anti-inflammatory medications, some of the antidepressants, they can work in the periphery to decrease bradykinin, neurokinin, and some of these inflammatory chemicals. The COX-2 inhibitors, the NSAIDs, can work in the periphery to decrease pain signals, which then cause a reduction in sodium channel conduction in these receptors, which causes decreased signaling to the spinal cord. So we can use sodium channel modulators that work in the periphery, and the sodium channel modulators could be some of the anticonvulsants or lidocaine medicines. Those can cause changes at the spinal cord. But the spinal cord and in the brain, there's multiple different neurochemicals, glutamate, which is excitatory, substance P, which is excitatory, GABA, which is inhibitory, bradykinin, which is inhibitory. So it gets very complex, but the medicines, for example, like gabapentin or pregabalin, they work at the spinal cord to block this excessive release of calcium. That excessive release of calcium causes hypersensitization of the neurons. And so inhibiting that calcium may decrease pain. So we may use those anticonvulsants for that mechanism. Moving up into the brain, it's even more complex with opioid receptors, our own endogenous opioid system, our own endogenous cannabinoid system, serotonin, norepinephrine, all those different chemicals. And so as a clinician, you may be using antidepressants that help increase serotonin and norepinephrine that at the brain may inhibit pain signals or help improve move. So it's important for the clinicians to be thinking of when they're giving these medications, what's the actual mechanism? Even though it's not just one medicine that's going to knock out the pain signal, but it gives them an idea of how are they going to use those medicines in a rational way to help decrease this kind of complex change in the neurochemicals in the body.
So a person who might have pain, someone in my family broke their toe and they were in the middle of nowhere. Mm-hmm. And they said that their mother had told them that they should drink vodka. Is that a useful old wives' tale or what?
Well, I'm not sure if it's appropriate to tell people to drink vodka for pain management, but I would think mechanistically, if we're going to talk about mechanisms, that alcohol, you know, causes increase in GABA, which can be inhibitory. It also has a significant effect in decreasing anxiety. And so, you know, maybe those grandmothers out there were giving alcohol to help people relax.
So it's a short-term the only thing, effect.
Right, is, you know,
sugar
to help decrease
the same,
their suffering.
Right? Sugar might be the same than the baby pacifiers in the nursery who have high doses of sugar. And maybe there's some effect there. And for cannabinoids, maybe it's an anti-inflammatory effect, if you had to guess why it might, the CBDs might be eventually proven safe and effective in clinical trials.
Yeah, there's definitely, you know, marijuana itself has so many hundreds of different chemicals involved, but CBD and trying to get a better understanding around CBD is going to be important because there may be mechanisms. We know there's mechanisms, just trying to better identify those that help with pain or help with appetite or anxiety, or in some cases, is there an anti-inflammatory effect? So I think that's an exciting time. There's still a lot of study that needs to be done with cannabinoids, and then obviously the important safety issues around those type of neurochemicals.
Sure. So, but as doctor, we react to the fact that someone's in pain, and they tell us they're in pain and that they're suffering, and our initial reaction is we can do something about this. We can remove that pain. We can help that person. And how should we manage ourselves and our own expectations in the face of what really exists in available pharmacological treatments and other treatments?
It's an important point because many times you have to set the right expectation with the patient. And if our patient first has a poor understanding of their underlying pain condition, and unfortunately in society, there's this thought that's not accurate that we can give a medicine for everything and people take their medicine and run down the beach smiling, you know. And that's just not the case. There's rarely a medicine that's going to decrease their pain completely. And so I like to explain to patients, like most drugs that we give, whether it's an anti-inflammatory, an antidepressant, even an opioid, most of those medications are going to help decrease their pain score maybe 2 to 3 points at the most. So an example with a patient would be, if we can get your pain down 1 or 2 points or 3 points, do you feel like you can be more active? Mm-hmm. And so really tie the intervention around the reduction in pain, but how that's going to affect what functional things they're not doing. And so also the patient's going to realize when they leave your exam room that the expectations can be more clear, because if a patient thinks their pain is going to be zero after any intervention we give, they're rarely going to see that, and there's going to be some animosity with the patient. So you really need to spend time, and I think going back to what you started talking about is that we want to help patients. Patients want relief. And so giving them the right expectations is important, giving them a little education on what they can expect. And what are the active things that they can do? They're going to feel better. So, you know, it's all about that kind of common understanding of what's happening and what the common goals are.
So other common things that people might take when they're in pain might be muscle relaxants, might be benzodiazepines, might be antidepressants. How do they fit into your way of understanding the pain treatment? And maybe could you give us an idea about how you'd approach a certain pain syndrome and what might be first, second, third, fourth?
Okay, so that's a good loaded question. I like that. That's good, yeah. So I would think so. A patient commonly we see has low back pain and leg pain. It may be due to neuropathic pain where they have, let's say, an L5 radiculopathy where the nerve root's irritated. They have shooting leg pain, but they're also not sleeping and their mood is depressed or sad. And so first, I think an analgesic, which would be there to help decrease their pain, is an anti-inflammatory medicine appropriate? Is there a role if they don't do well with those types of medicines for an opioid as a trial to see if that can help decrease their pain? So the opioid would be helping to try to increase GABA or decrease the release of substance P and glutamate if we want to talk specifically about mechanisms. Medicines for sleep, we really avoid benzodiazepines because benzodiazepines may have an anxiolytic effect, but there's a tolerance effect, and in some patients it may actually make their sleep architecture worse. So are there other medicines they can use for sleep? I like to use a lot of trazodone. That increases serotonin and helps people sleep deeper. But even sleep, there's, you know, besides medicines, you have a good discussion with the patient about sleep hygiene. You know, what are they drinking caffeine before they go to bed? Are they napping all day and then having trouble falling asleep? So there's some non-pharmacologic things too. But going back to the medicines with our patient with low back pain, you may, again, use a medication for sleep, an analgesic like an anti-inflammatory at therapeutic doses to see if that can help. You may use an antidepressant. It's interesting, antidepressants have a number of different mechanisms. The old classic, like amitriptyline, is a tricyclic antidepressant. It increases serotonin and norepinephrine, which can inhibit pain signals. It also can have an effect on mood. There are some thoughts that the tricyclic antidepressants even have an indirect opioid effect. So that's kind of what we describe as the dirty bomb of pain medicine. The old tricyclic antidepressants can be useful. They have a number of different mechanisms that can help decrease pain. In some cases, the side effects may actually help with sleep because they cause some sedation. So that's just an example of the complexity of these medicines, whether you're thinking about analgesia, thinking about like neuropathic pain and how you're helping with that, or sleep. The last medicine that we commonly use for neuropathic pain, many of the anticonvulsants can help decrease sensitization along nerve roots. Gabapentin is indicated on the FDA for postherpetic neuralgia, but it's used off-label for nerve pain, and that would help decrease, in many cases, that we're thinking the mechanism is this excessive calcium that increases at the spinal cord, and you can use gabapentin to help decrease that calcium, and that may help quiet the pain signals. I like to explain it. There's a little, you've got interference, there's a little static on the radio signal. It's gonna quiet that static down. It doesn't block the nerve impulses, but it quiets down the hyperexcitability of the nerve. So these are kind of the basic general kind of understandings that we have of these mechanisms of these medicines that we commonly used for pain medicine.
So, you know, when not to go back in the day, but in the day we had malignant and non-malignant pain.
Right.
And now you have this new nomenclature that includes three different types of pain. Do we still use the old terms, and do they have any relevance?
Well, I'm not sure if there's any more relevance now with malignant versus non-malignant pain, because patients with cancer pain need to be treated appropriately. People with non-cancer pain need to be treated appropriately. Some people think the term malignant can be used many different ways, separate from cancer. So I think the understanding's been more going back to this newer nomenclature, which is nociceptive, neuropathic, and the newer one, which really is around central sensitization, is called nociplastic pain. So we have three different types. And again, it's more just to give people a guide, even we know our nervous system is a lot more complex than that, but it gives you an idea of where to think about where you're gonna focus your medications. What's their underlying cause of pain? The one thing, Mark, I want to mention is that many of our patients have muscle-related pain. And, mm-hmm. and that mechanism is very different. And that can involve almost like organ pain, but it can also involve nociceptive and neuropathic pathways. So, you know, the idea of these three buckets is really more to simplify things in our thought process, but also having the understanding that our nervous system is very complex, whether it's in the skin, the muscle, along the spinal cord, or in these other soft tissues that have nociceptors.
It seems like a daunting task for someone to evaluate a pain patient without being in a pain expert arena.
Well, I think it's maybe not a daunting task. I think it's, it, for me as a pain clinician, as any physician or provider, I think it helps us understand the complexities of our nervous system, and it gives us a lot of targets for treatment. You know, just our understanding of heat and cold. I mean, mm-hmm. just in the last 10, 15 years did they identify heat and cold receptors, mm-hmm. yet we've been using heat and cold for millennia. Right, mm-hmm. but how does it actually work? How are those receptors affected? Well, I think it's, you know, it's a typical example that a lot of these things we've done to our body.
You're from the Swedish hospital. I mean, like, how does a sauna work?
Well, let's just say the heat receptors can, because if you think about it, if you jump in that hot sauna and your body quickly sensitizes to the heat, then you feel comfortable, or you jump in a cold pool and your receptors sensitize to that or desensitize to that. But very complex. And some of those heat and cold receptors can inhibit pain signals, and some of those are actually there to help increase the inflammatory response. So, you know, now we've seen this huge growth in topical analgesics, mm-hmm. cold bombs, heat topical preparations. And again, I think it's just giving people more tools so they can help patients manage their pain better.
So I'd like to thank you for being with us to learn about pain and to update our skills with regard to pain assessment and treatment. And thanks to Steve for being here from a pain expert's point of view at the Swedish Hospital in Seattle, Washington.
Thanks, Mark. It was great speaking with you.